Welcome to 2021, when your beard can be all it can be. How? By visiting the Fable Beard Company websites. As you know, they are the official beard company of the American History Podcast. And, as this episode airs, it is now 2021. So, new year, new you. Get it started right by using one of their many amazing beard products to help soften your beard and hydrate it so it's the best beard you can possibly have. Now, when it comes to beard products, I'm a huge fan of beard oils and butters that are infused with CBD. I've used their roaster-scented CBD oil, which is fantastic, as is their latest one, the Baker. This particular oil is complete with a fantastic scent profile and the quality that only Fable Beard Company can deliver. Each bottle contains 50 milligrams of CO2 expressed full-spectrum CBD oil. Oh, and that scent profile? It's fresh-baked pastry, warm vanilla sugar, and just a hint of cinnamon spice. Believe me, gentlemen, the wife or the girlfriend is going to love it. Head over to FableBeardCompany.com and use the coupon code SEAN15 for 15% off the entire order. That's right, 15% off the entire order for listeners of this show. If CBD isn't your thing, then head over to FableBeardCo.com and check out all of their oils and butters, as well as beard conditioners and even products for women that don't have CBD in them. The coupon code works over there as well. Remember, it's SEAN15, the number 15, and let's start off the new year right. Now, on with the show. The American History Podcast, Season 3, Episode 27, Hoover and the Great Depression.
Welcome to the American History Podcast. Hosted by Sean Worswick.
Welcome back. Now, believe it or not, we're getting close to the end of Season 3. If you're enjoying the show, and I truly hope you are, head over to Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star rating or even a review. That really does help people find the show. Let me encourage you to visit the website and sign up for the email updates. You can also see the sources that are used to create the current season, and if you'd like to purchase one of them, they are hyperlinked, and it will take you directly to Amazon. Now, if you would like to support the show, there are several ways that you can do so. First, sign up for the Patreon. For the price of one coffee a month, you'll get access to bonus episodes, the series 1983, the year the world almost ended, scripts of each show, and you get the show's commercial free. And I have to say, the Patreon-only series 1983 is fantastic, even if I do say so myself. We're just getting into the meat of that series, and there should be another episode here in the next month. So, it's the perfect time to sign up. You'll get somewhere between 5 to 8 hours of content to consume that is unavailable anywhere else. And speaking of Patreon, we've got a couple of new members who I'd like to thank, Harriet and Matt. Thank you so much for joining, and I hope you're enjoying the content. Now, if you're not into Patreon, and I get that, but you'd still like to support the show, you can do so by entering Amazon from our site every time you shop. Doing so will cause them to send us a few pennies, and it costs you absolutely nothing. Just click on one of the hyperlinked sources over at theamericanhistorypodcast.com. Even if you don't purchase that item, we still get some money, so thank you for that. Finally, do you have a question or maybe just want to interact with me? You can send me an email at sean@theamericanhistorypodcast.com. I try to answer all of them in a timely manner, so don't worry, I will answer. You can follow me on Twitter as well. The handle is @AmericanHisCast. And we are also on both Instagram and Facebook. So if you want to see my ugly mug, just head over and say hello. All right, so this is going to be a long episode. So for the song of the week, let's get to it. This is the song of the week. It is Happy Days Are Here Again. See ya on the other side. Thank you. So it's 1928, election season. President Coolidge, in the summer of 1927, had issued a short statement saying that he would not be running for re-election in 1928. It was his usual style, quote, "I do not choose to run for president in 1928," end quote. This opened the path for Herbert Hoover. Now, make no mistake, Coolidge, to put it lightly, didn't exactly endorse Hoover. There is a quote from Coolidge on his successor, which should help us understand that Hoover wasn't exactly following the tradition of his predecessor. Quote, "For 6 years, that man has given me unsolicited advice. All of it bad," end quote. Not exactly a ringing endorsement. Gotta love Calvin Coolidge, right? Well, anyway, Hoover ends up being the Republican nominee. He ran on a platform of prosperity and prohibition. Now, the Democrats, they nominated Alfred E. Smith, the first Irish-American Catholic nominated by a major party. Smith had been a Tammany Hall boss, and he was the, quote, "wet son" of Irish immigrants. All of this meant the South and the rural areas were deeply opposed to him. Now, the campaign featured the first time radio was significantly used as an election tool. Hoover warned of socialism and preached the need for rugged individualism. Sadly, it also saw religious bigotry surface in the form of attacks on Smith's Catholic religion. Quote, "A vote for Al Smith is a vote for the Pope," end quote. Now, of course, in the end, the Republicans easily won, defeating Smith 444-87 in the Electoral College. The Republicans, for the first time in 50 years, even won several states that had been part of the Confederacy, including Texas and Florida. Furthermore, the Republicans saw a huge majority returned to the House of Representatives. Now this brings us to the actual Hoover presidency. One of the myths that's oft repeated when it comes to Hoover is the idea that he was Mr. Laissez-faire. In fact, he was not. I remember, and I might have said this about him already, but Hoover was an engineer. Now in my experience, and granted this is simply anecdotal evidence, but I've never met an engineer who wasn't a type A personality. The idea that he would just let the economy do its thing seems counter to every engineer I've ever met. He not only organized food drives for the starving people in Belgium during World War I, but his leadership of the food administration during that conflict earned him the titles of, quote, "great engineer," end quote, and "wonder boy." Further, as Secretary of Commerce, Hoover supported some progressive ideas, for example, endorsing labor unions and supporting federal regulations for the new radio broadcasting industry. Now, for a time, he even considered the idea of a government-owned radio service similar to Britain's BBC. He also declared in 1928 that, quote, "poverty will be banished from the nation," end quote, and, quote, "everybody ought to be rich," end quote. Now, that all sounds great, and in a perfect world, that would be true. However, we live in a world of scarcity. We can't all be rich, not monetarily speaking anyway. Now, having said that, Hoover, in his inaugural address, waxed enthusiastic about the prosperity of the 1920s. Indeed, it actually was fashionable by the time Hoover took office to talk about how the United States had entered a permanent phase of prosperity. The president believed that the United States had been liberated from poverty by the previous 8 years of Republican Party leadership. In the 1928 campaign, he had promised a chicken in every pot and a car in every garage, as the saying goes. And believe it or not, those claims were not seen as crazy. The majority of people believed this. Now, as a matter of fact, and I mentioned this a moment ago, talk was that this was an era of permanent prosperity. Thanks to scientific management of the economy by the Federal Reserve, the normal boom and bust cycle had been relegated to the dustbin of history. Now, of course, nothing could be further from the truth. As we all know, the biggest boom of them all was underway, and it would be followed, as night follows day, by the biggest bust ever. And I'd actually say that you know a bust is coming when this sort of silly talk enters the zeitgeist. This is what we saw in the late 1990s, as people started to say silly things, like the stock market will not go down. It never goes down. Heck, you could even read books like David Elias's Dow 40,000, published in 1999. That was on the eve of the dot-com bust. But that's a topic for a different episode. I'd simply say here that when you hear nonsense like this, buckle your seatbelts. Things are about to get bumpy. Now, we're going to discuss the Federal Reserve and the causes of the Great Depression in a future episode. It's the one after this. But for now, let me just suggest that the idea that the 1920s were a time of unbridled laissez-faire economics is totally wrong. The facts don't show that at all. And I say this because it's always the free market that's blamed, or at least it is in many of the standard textbooks. The so-called master narrative is that it's the fault of the free market that we had this Great Depression. Now, furthermore, one often hears that this is why we need a great helmsman, to help steer the economy. Otherwise, you're going to get this wild ride and then the inevitable crash. This is how Alan Greenspan was often treated, like he was this great helmsman. He would go before Congress and speak to the banking committee and often expected them to start waving incense before the guy and start bowing down to him. Of course, I disagree with this assessment totally. To quote the great Tom Woods, I believe the great helmsman is more of a drunk driver than a great helmsman. This is basically what the Austrian school says. Now, I don't want to spend too much time on this, as I've discussed the Austrian school elsewhere. Suffice it to say, it's not an actual school, but a school of thought. And while it has gained in popularity over the last decade or so, especially since the Great Recession of 2008, the reality is it's the oldest continuing school of economic thought in the world. It doesn't have anything to do with Austria in reality. And although there were certainly some of its early proponents who hailed from Austria, most famously both Ludwig von Mises and his student F.A. Hayek, the winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics in 1974, for his work on the business cycle. And we'll discuss this in a much more in-depth episode come episode 28. But hopefully for now, this will suffice. Now this brings us back to the crash of 1929. The 1920s saw what is called a bull market, which is when the value of stocks increases. This is what we saw throughout the decade. The Dow Jones Industrial Average in 1924 was at 180. In September 1929, it stood at 381, and stocks were selling for an average of 16 times their earning. Now, just a general rule of thumb is that it should be about 10 times the average. So you can see they were certainly overpriced. Now, another problem was the fact that people were engaged in the practice of buying stocks on margin. And this is when you purchase stocks from a broker and only have to put down about 5% of the purchase price to buy them. The idea was that because stocks never go down in value, you could buy, say, $100 a stock and only have to put $5 down. And then when the stock earned enough, you'd pay back the difference with the proceeds. Now, if the payment wasn't made, the stocks were taken to pay the debt. If the price dropped by, say, 10% or more, the broker would then sell the stock to get back as much as they could. The result of all of this is that banks and businesses which had financed the loans were in dire strait if a bust ever came. Well, guess what? The bust came. Now, I should quickly mention the fact that marginal buying doesn't account for the bust in and of itself. This was not a new practice as well, okay? While Hoover wanted to tighten up the system, the reality is that marginal requirements rose in 1928. Another problem that was related to this, and that was speculation. Investors gambled that prices would continue to rise. So this, coupled with easy money thanks to the policy of the Federal Reserve to inflate the dollar, meant that speculation was easy and rampant. But again, what if a bust came? Now, as I mentioned earlier, and to his credit, Hoover did try to end this early in his presidency by pressuring the Federal Reserve Board to raise interest rates. But by the summer of 1929, there were warning signs. The economy was showing signs of a downturn, and that worked its way into Wall Street. On September 3rd, the market reached its high watermark of 381, and then declined by October 21st to 320. Then the bottom fell out on Black Thursday, October 24th, and on Tragic Tuesday, October 29th. Now the slide stopped on November the 13th as the Dow hit 198, and in fact the market saw a recovery by April of 1930 when the Dow reached 294. However, from that point forward, it began falling again and continued to do so all the way through the summer of 1932, and the Great Depression had well and truly arrived. Now by November 1929, although the slide was halted, $25 billion in stock value had been erased, and overnight fortunes were gone. By 1932, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down to 41. The United States did not sink totally into depression until December of 1930, after several major banks collapsed. The bank that is often seen as the one that started the collapse of banking at this point was a major private bank in New York, the Bank of the United States. Now, bank run on its branch in the Bronx led to the collapse of this bank. Needless to say, this then sent shockwaves through the industry, as this was the first time a major New York bank had collapsed since 1907. Now, by 1932, over 5,000 banks had failed, approximately 22% of the banks in the country. 4,000 failed between December 1932 and the inauguration of President Franklin D. Roosevelt in March 1933. Thousands of businesses failed, 20,000 in 1929 and 30,000 more in 1932. business investment decreased by approximately 95% between 1929 and 1932. Unemployment reached 25% by 1932. This was about 13 million people, excluding farmers. If we include farmers, then some estimates put the number at 33%. In some areas, it was even worse. For example, Chicago saw about 50% unemployment. Now keep in mind that prior to the economic crash, unemployment in 1929 was 3.2%. The auto industry was functioning at 20% of capacity by 1932, and the steel industry was down to 12%. Now this is especially insightful, and I want you to keep this in mind when I discuss the various theories about what caused this in the next episode. If this wasn't enough, total wages dropped from $12 billion to $7 billion between 1929 and 1932, a difference of about 41%. You also had an increase in child labor, as many families needed the kids to work just to survive. Now, as we will discuss in the next episode, the Depression hit the higher orders of production far harder than those closer to the consumer, and I just hinted at it with some of those stats. However, farmers also suffered. By 1932, 25% of farmers had lost their farms. A major cause was the large drop in food prices that was caused by a drop in demand from Europe. The human toll was catastrophic. Many experienced a loss of self-worth. Many families broke up, and both the marriage rate and the birth rate dropped. In many cases, families doubled up in houses and apartments just to get by. 3 million people became hobos and lived in makeshift shacks known as Hoovervilles. Malnutrition was rampant in some areas, but death by starvation was uncommon. Nonetheless, malnutrition caused people to be more susceptible to fatal disease. Now, this was, without a doubt, the longest and most devastating economic depression in U.S. history. The U.S. was hit hardest amongst industrialized nations. Gross national product, or GNP, fell from $104 billion in 1929 to $56.1 billion in 1933. The international reparations and war debt structure that was put in place after World War I, that collapsed. U.S. exports dropped, further hurting the U.S. economy. It was not until after World War II that the Depression could be said to have ended. Okay, now I know you've heard that World War II got us out of the Great Depression, but this is just not true. Historian Robert Higgs, who is now retired but was an economic historian and taught at Washington University as well as Oxford and Stanford as a visiting scholar, argues that in fact the U.S. economy did not emerge from the Depression until World War II was over. Higgs notes that the orthodox view, that peak prosperity in the 1940s was between 1943 and 1945, is totally wrong. Why? The numbers were being boosted by the fact that the United States was engaged in war. 16 million men were serving in the military, and the government was running huge deficits as it spent enormous sums of money building planes, ships, and other armaments of war. Furthermore, we must understand that many of the people serving in the military were doing so under duress. They were conscripted into service. Higgs estimates that somewhere near 22% of the pre-war labor force was forced into the military. Well, it's no doubt unemployment was now virtually gone. But was this prosperity? One could not simply go out and purchase a car, for example. None were available. Heck, even such staples as meat and coffee were hard to come by, and families were issued ration cards. Does this sound like an economy that has recovered? One must also consider that, out of all of these goods that were being produced, how many were for the civilian sector? It's not like you could go out and buy a Sherman tank, an F-4 Wildcat, or an aircraft carrier. So how much better off were you in 1943 compared to, say, 1939? Certainly, there are some who argue that the war years were the best ever. Seymour Melman, for example, argued, "The economy was producing more guns and more butter. Americans had never had it so good." But as Higgs points out, this is not close to being correct. First, it fails to take into account the actual wartime inflation, the deterioration of both the quality of consumer goods and the outright disappearance from the market of many items that consumers wanted. When corrected for this, 1943 was actually one of the most difficult years for the country since the darkest days of the Depression. So how did Hoover respond? Now, the standard narrative is that he was Mr. Non-Interference, and he took too long to finally do something. But of course, as I've said, this was far from the case. Instead, he moved to cushion the shock of the stock market collapse fairly quickly. Unlike President Harding, Hoover decided that he would not allow wages to decline and unemployment to rise as it had in 1921. Describing the previous depression as a liquidation, he convened White House conferences with leaders from various industrial, construction, and public utility firms on November 18, 21, 22, and 27 of 1929 to coordinate actions of government with business so they could minimize the harmful effects of the contraction and keep it brief. Hoover's message to all groups was essentially that wages needed to be maintained at current levels so all workers could keep their purchasing power at the present level. Furthermore, he insisted firms should do everything they could to maintain employment, and any work reduction should be spread across the entire labor force by reducing the work week instead of laying workers off. He also suggested they allow profits to fall instead of cutting wages. Lastly, firms should continue to invest in buildings and machinery. As you will see, this was some of the worst advice in history. But this wasn't all. It actually gets worse. Hoover urged the Chamber of Commerce to set up the National Business Survey Conference to survey and obtain a pledge from businesses that they would maintain wages and pursue new investment. He even had a new division created in the Commerce Department, which attempted to speed federal construction projects. Sound familiar? And obtain promises from state and local governments to engage in more construction. So let me ask you this. Was this the man who believed in the free market and the invisible hand? Doesn't sound like it to me. They even cut taxes for each bracket by 1% for a year across the board, which might not sound like much, but they had been cut since the highs under Wilson. Then, in order to help farmers, he had two programs, one of which was passed by Congress prior to the crash. The first was the Agricultural Marketing Act, designed to help farmers help themselves, and mostly through the use of producers' cooperatives. Now, this was the evidence of Hoover's progressive tendencies, and it was the sort of policy Calvin Coolidge had vetoed. Post-crash, Hoover established the Federal Farm Board with a revolving fund of $500 million. It lent money to buy, sell, and store American agricultural surpluses and sold them abroad. The goal of this was to increase sagging prices by purchasing surpluses and then selling them abroad. The policy was a failure. Why? It artificially propped up prices, which only incentivized farmers to either produce the same amount of food or actually increase what they were growing. Now, in the end, they had to finally dump all their inventories, which then depressed prices and worsened the depression in the agricultural sector. All of this failed to work. Unlike the Depression of 1921, which lasted for about a year or so before the economy was well on its way to recovery, this depression deepened. This then led to calls for a tariff bill, which resulted in the Hawley-Smoot Tariff Bill of 1930. This was the highest peacetime tariff in the history of the United States. The average duty or tax imposed on imported goods increased from 38.5% to nearly 60%. Even though the over 1,000 economists signed a letter urging President Hoover not to sign the bill, he did so on June 1930. International trade, already suffering due to the worldwide depression, now went into a tailspin. Believe it or not, at least initially, it appeared that some of what Hoover advocated was working. The depression seemed to lessen in early 1930, and stock prices, as I mentioned before, rose. However, starting in June, it was obvious that what was happening is that the economic crisis was deepening. Incomes continued to decline, and GNP fell. The average rate of unemployment in 1929 was 3.2%. By 1930, it was 8.9%. Estimates place it at about 15% by December 1930. And to make matters worse, a drought hit the southern regions of the United States in a belt stretching from Maryland through to Arkansas. Now, if you thought this was all, it wasn't. In 1930, Congress appropriated $750 million for public buildings, river and harbor improvements, and highway construction to stimulate employment. Construction of the Hoover Dam began in 1931 and was completed in 1936. This project employed thousands and created a huge man-made lake for irrigation, flood control, and electric power. By 1932, despite the efforts of Congress and the president to reverse the economic downturn, nothing was working. So this brings us to one of Hoover's last measures, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, or RFC. Created in 1932, it had a budget of $500 million and the authority to borrow another $1.5 billion to make loans to railroads, banks, and other financial institutions. Later that year, Hoover even approved legislation authorizing the RFC to loan $300 million to states for relief, and to make loans to states and cities so that they could self-liquidate public works. In the end, this became the blueprint for the New Deal and the presidency of Franklin D. Roosevelt. All right, so now it's time to evaluate Hoover. Despite the claim that he did not do enough, I think you can see he went further than anyone at that time could have or would have expected. Indeed, many historians who say he didn't go far enough in one breath will then note he advocated for more direct government involvement than any previous president in history up to that point. The Orthodox story then goes on to say that he probably prevented a more serious collapse. Sure. They also note his policies paved the way for the New Deal. If that's the case, then why is it that the Orthodox narrative also paints him as Mr. Free Market? Now, before we go, let me just say this. I would argue that President Hoover had the blueprint for economic recovery. Follow the model set in 1921. However, his progressive tendencies did not allow him to pursue a hands-off policy. Instead, what he did made the contraction worse. Next time, we will discuss the causes of the Depression and what should have been done by Hoover. I have hinted at all of this before, but it's time to unveil the truth about what caused this and what should have been done. Now, before we go, let me just say this about Hoover. According to Amity Schles, the author of the fantastic biography on Coolidge and a great book on the Depression called The Forgotten Man, there was a new air about the White House in the Hoover administration, one that was quite different from that of Calvin Coolidge. The atmosphere, according to newspaper editor Alan White, was akin to that of Theodore Roosevelt and his administration, muffled perhaps, but just as vigorous. The last thing Roosevelt was hands-off. He was a progressive through and through. Guess what? So was Hoover. Until next time, have a great day. Do you like the sound of the American History Podcast? My audio production is provided by the Mad Octopus. Check them out over at madoctopusmedia.com.